The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
How's that? Better? Well, it's really nice to be here. Feels a little different sitting up here. Is a quality of mind that brings us to this practice, and it keeps us going on this path. In Japanese, the term is do-shin. It usually gets translated as way-seeking mind. This is the mind or the heart that seeks the way, seeks the truth, is looking for the truth. And I think it's what brings all of us here, because insight meditation, vipassana, is one way to find out what's true, one way to see the truth, to see the Dharma. So, way-seeking mind is kind of like the spirit of our practice. And there is a tradition of sharing your way-seeking mind with others. You're kind of sharing a little bit about your practice and what you've learned on the path. So if that's okay, that's what I would like to do tonight. I was born in Brooklyn, New York. Anyone from Brooklyn? Okay. There was something special about you. Greens. The oldest of three siblings. My father died when I was 13 years old. My mother is still very much alive. She's a teacher and educator of small children for many years. And I think both my father and my mother were very nurturing people. So I feel very lucky. They're kind of wonderful role models of unconditional love. When I was in high school, which was about 20 years ago, there was a television program on PBS. Maybe some of you remember that. I watched a lot of TV. On PBS called Healing in the Mind. It was a Bill Moyers, he's a wonderful journalist. And the program explored the connection between the mind and the body. So it profiled people, pioneers who were researching in this field. And one of the segments profiled someone named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who you may have heard of, who is the founder of the mindfulness-based stress reduction clinic in Massachusetts. And I don't know why, I just really liked that program, and I even bought the book. It was kind of, it was a book, the transcripts of the interviews, And I just kind of filed it away. I moved here to California for college at Stanford. And in my second year, when I was 18 years old, I became quite ill. It was a kind of unusual allergic reaction to the medicine I was taking. And it left me very weak. I could hardly walk. And I was recovering, but quite slowly. And in addition to the physical problems, I had a lot of stress, a lot of worry. Just still living in a dorm with all these other, 18-year-olds, and I was kind of like an old man, slowly moving. And I went to the Stanford bookstore and I found a book by Jon Kabat-Zinn, this guy I'd seen on TV. And it was his first book, which is, I think, called Living the Full Catastrophe. Full Catastrophe Living. And I really liked that book. I really appreciated it. I read it cover to cover, and I sent away, at that time it was just cassettes, so kind of clipped the back, and I sent away, and I got the cassettes, because he was leading these guided meditations, there was a guided body scan, and a sitting meditation. I never did the sitting meditation because that was a little boring. The guided body meditation, body scan, and then the yoga. And there was a 45 minutes of yoga on each side. And every day, I would play the tape in my room, and I would do, you know, about 2 hours of this kind of mindfulness, slow yoga. They do a body scan, and I just thought it was really great. It made such a big difference for me in how I experienced my body. Something about learning this skill, this really basic skill, to be mindfully present for my experience. So I think that was kind of a turning point for me. And something about being sick had given me a jolt. And I've heard that over and over again. I feel that there's something like when you're forced to practice and something, you know, something disrupts that, you know, the story of how you think your life should be, you can really practice and you can really go very deeply, I think. So looking back now, I feel grateful for that illness when I was 18 years old. And so I think about it as a kind of the condition that aroused my way-seeking mind. And I think one of the things that I discovered or noticed through doing all that mindfulness, the kind of very basic mindfulness practice, was a kind of intimacy that I had never experienced before with my body. I remember feeling so close, so connected to my body. And I would kind of slowly walk to class. I mean, now when you go on retreat, you walk slowly, right? But that was because I just couldn't walk any faster. It was like very slowly. But I just felt, you know, it's like I feel really alive. There was something so connected, so in tune. So that kind of made an imprint on me, or made an impression. I had a lot of stress, and I had a hard time falling asleep. I would get in bed, and there would be this cycle, this loop of thinking. And through doing this practice, something shifted. So it was like I was so used to paying attention to the sensations of my body, that when I would get in bed, the mind would just naturally feel. It would feel the pillow, feel the weight of the blanket. And I thought, wow, I mean, am I enlightened? It wasn't. But it was such a... It's like I was being freed from the tyranny of thinking, you know, because the sensations of just normal sensations of feeling the pillow on my cheek were much more compelling than any thoughts that I could generate. You know, it was very interesting to me. And then, you know, as it happens, my health improved, eventually kind of fully recovered, and I felt less compelled to do this very intensive practice. And that, you know, and that way of being, it just faded. I remembered it, but I felt it kind of slipping away. And but I always remembered it. A few years later, maybe 3 or 4 years later, I had graduated from college, and this was in the late 90s, and it was in the middle of the tech boom in this area. Some of you, I'm sure, lived through it, still living through it. And I followed some friends into a small startup at the time, which had a funny name, and it was called Google. And that's a whole nother story. But I was working there for a few months, and a woman who was a colleague of mine, I didn't really know her well, I wasn't friends with her, she said to me, she said, "Hey, Max, I'm going to this meditation group on Monday nights, and I really think you would like it. And I really think you would like the teacher, and the teacher's this really interesting guy, and I think you should come." And I said, "Okay." And, and that group was this very group. This was the IMC. It was, at that time, the group was meeting in Palo Alto in the Quaker Friends Meeting House. I think I recognize some faces from there. It was just on the other side of 101 from my office, so it was really, really convenient. And I remember going in the first time, and the room was set up where there were chairs on two sides, and there were cushions facing each other, and there were cushions in the middle, and the teacher sat in the front. And everyone was just kind of sitting quietly, you know, and I walked in, and I sat down in a chair, and I just waited. You know, just waiting to start. You know. it took me a while. I'm a little slow, and it took me a while to realize, you know, this was it. Okay, I can do this. You know, just sit there. And also, I remember after the talk, walking out of the building and walking through the parking lot into the street to my car, and it just, everything seemed so beautiful, so exquisitely calm, this quiet, calm night. And I thought, what changed? You know, what had happened there? Something about, and I really appreciated Gil. Gil Fronsthal was the teacher that night, and what I liked about Gil is that I felt that he wasn't trying to sell anything. He wasn't trying to convince me of something. I was working in sales, and so, you know, it's a kind of different way of being. And I just felt that this was a person who had seemed to have a lot of integrity, something about him, a lot of integrity. And the message I got, you know, from the teachings or from the first couple of talks was also really powerful for me. It was kind of like, finally, somebody is telling the truth, you know, about how things are. And I can't remember what he said that night, but the basic feeling that I got, or the basic message that I received, was that fundamentally, life is never going to be what we want it to be. And I was like, exactly, you know, that's right. You know? Why isn't anybody else saying this? we deeply want safety. We deeply want permanence. We want security. we want to get what we want and get away from what we don't want. I mean, it's just such a deep conditioning. And this kind of clinging creates suffering for us. And I just felt like Gil was talking about that so directly, and it just made so much sense. And I never could have articulated that to myself. But hearing him say that, I thought, yes, that rings true to me. You know, demanding that life, demanding that other people conform to our expectations is painful. You know, it's a tremendous burden to carry. So just hearing Gil say something like, life isn't ever going to work out like that was very powerful for me. And in a way, you know, if that was the bad news, there was good news too. You know, it wasn't just like, you know, that's the bad news. Good night, everybody. What I felt, what I was hearing, is the good news was that we could choose life as it is. You know, we could choose to kind of enter into our life as it actually is, as opposed to all of our ideas about it. And then this meditation practice is offered as a safe place to do that. And I just thought, this is really, really great. There's something very unique about this message. And I feel like one of the things that Gil talked about a lot at that time was the ideal versus the actual. You know, these two poles, like the ideal and the actual. And this is such a basic division or split, you know, way we divide our experience. How my life is versus how I want it to be. How I am versus how I think I should be. You know, this is how we divide our experience. And the usual way of thinking about this is like, the way my life actually is a problem. You know, there's some problem. And then there's some solution, some ideal solution. And I think that's a usual, at least that's my usual way of thinking of things. And then Gil said, whenever we have a choice between the ideal and the actual, we choose the actual. And I thought, well, but the ideal's better. The reason we choose the actual is because, you know, of course, because the ideal doesn't exist. You know, the actual is what exists. And something about getting out of my head and getting into the actual experience of my life just made complete sense to me. And I just thought, this is really, this is so fundamental. It's like the heart of the matter. You know, and of course the meditation was, I found it very difficult. I had no discipline to sit on my own, so coming to the group or coming to different groups was so helpful to me. And a lot of times it was just a victory to stay in the room, you know, to stay in my seat. I remember a few times when I came to the group and I saw that the teacher wasn't Gil. And I, you know, I thought, can I leave? And I just kept coming back. And I think something about this way-seeking mind could grow. It could grow. It just became something that was a big part of my life. You know, I'd work in kind of intensive job, And then after work was I would come, we'd come here a couple times a week, and there, you know, other groups you can kind of go to, and it was really great for me. So sometimes during Gil's talks, he would reference something called Zen. He would talk about his time as a Zen monk, or, you know, different Zen teachers like Suzuki Roshi. And I began to, you know, I ordered some books about Zen and I began to read. And I thought, you know, this is pretty good too. And I began going to Dharma talks at Zen centers. At the time I was living in Mountain View, and I didn't know it, but the house that I was living in was owned by a Zen center. It was a Kanando Zen center, which some of you may have gone to. This was when they had a little house that was, you know, closer to El Camino in Mountain View. And I was living in this really old house that they eventually tore down, and they built a new Zendo there. It had no heating. Anyway, that's another story. But I would, in the morning, I would drive over about 5 in the morning to sit Zazen, Zen meditation, at this Zendo. And I would sit every morning with them. And in the evenings, I would sit Vipassana. I'd do Vipassana. Sometimes I would meet with Gil, and we would take a walk, and we would talk about practice. And I remember one time telling Gil that I have a two-prong strategy for happiness. Kind of like a parallel strategy. And he's like, okay, you know. The first strategy is to, you know, kind of to make so much money, so to have so much resources that I could satisfy every desire that I could have, and then I'll be happy. And then the second strategy was to have few desires. So, and I don't remember what he said, but it was something like, let me know how that works out for you. So I kind of had these parallel tracks. And sort of unbelievably to me, both of those were kind of blossoming at the same time. I was working at this company at Google, which was just overflowing, which was just growing so fast, is getting so popular, so profitable. And then at the same time, I was really getting drawn into Dharma practice. And kind of my head was overflowing with, you know, so many books and talks and, you know, retreats, short retreats. And after a while, I felt, maybe around 2004, 2003, 2004, I felt about Google, I've got to get out of here. You know, it's too comfortable. It's too nice. This is kind of like, if I don't do it now, I don't know. And so I'd been practicing for about three or four years. I was 26 years old, and I quit my job, and I moved to Tassajara, which is this, some of you may know it, it's a Zen monastery in Carmel Valley, near Big Sur, and went on a three-month retreat, and ended up doing 6 months of retreat that year. So that was another big turning point for me. And a big practice question for me at that time, something that was really, really compelling to me, was what is the difference between Zen and Vipassana? That was, I don't know why, that was such a big issue for me. And you know, they're kind of sibling practices. And now I would say that I feel at their deepest level, there isn't a difference. But they do have different approaches. So one of the ways I came to understand it for myself was that Vipassana was something active. It was like, you know, there's something to do. You can follow your breath. You can open to sounds. You can open to sensations in the body. And in a way, it's a kind of doing. And then as the practice unfolds, you know, that doing sort of undoes itself. And Zen, at least the way I was practicing it, sort of took the other side. Very receptive, very accepting, kind of, it was like a non-doing. One quote that comes to mind from Suzuki Roshi was something like, reality is like a bed that is so soft and so deep, it can accept everything exactly as it is. You know, that kind of feeling to it. And I really like that. Something about that really spoke to me. I feel that in a way, for Vipassana for me, it was almost all too easy to turn it into a project. You know, like everything else in my life, you know, kind of that I could evaluate myself on. You know, you can either do it well or you not do it so well. You know, how many breaths can you stay with, kind of thing. And Zen just totally destroys that. It's like, it pulls the rug out from under you. Very early on, I asked a Zen teacher named Mel Weitzman at Tassajara. I went up to him and I said, what do you do when you sit Zazen? And he said, you know, I kind of expect him to say, well, I follow my breath, you know. And he said, I express who I really am. You know, so over and over, I would kind of ask, you know, what are you doing here? And he'll say, we're not going to tell you how to do this. And so at Tassajara, it's like instead of meditation instruction, what is offered is something called the practice of just sitting. And my understanding of that, or the way I kind of could relate to it, was just sitting was like just experiencing your life. As it is, as it actually is, without trying to change it, without trying to tinker, as someone says. And it flows from the insight that the point of practice is to be yourself. And so it's, you know, in a way, it's like, how could you do it right and how could you do it wrong? How could someone else tell you how to be you? It doesn't make sense. So something about that was very helpful to me. It was like just showing up to this moment, however the moment presents itself. And for me, this turned meditation into a refuge. In a way, I could finally stop evaluating myself and, you know, and just sit, just, you know, without any sense of, you know, there's a right way to do this. You know, along with this, there was another big learning for me there was this idea of no gain. You may come across this in Zen books, but it was particularly important to this kind of practice. And the idea was just to do something for the sake of doing it. That the the payoff for an activity is in the activity itself. And that was like, you know, what? I just think it goes against the grain so much of at least my conditioning. You know, we do things to get results. And it's the same way with practice. It's like, I don't know, you know, we so deeply need to feel that we're going to get something out of all this practice that we do or don't do. And, you know, so this idea of no gain. And in a way, I think we need a fantasy to bring us to practice. You know, what this practice is going to do for me, how this is going to change me in some way. And it's like the fantasy is like the ideal. And then the practice of mindfulness is the practice of the actual. You know, so we bring all our fantasies, it's fine. And we just come in and we just practice with them. So just sitting, no gain. And then the third thing that I think I kind of got from Tassajara was physical pain. in Zen, the instruction or the request is to sit still. So, you know, don't move. You know, when you meditate, and when you don't move for a long time, there's going to be some physical pain. And the idea, as best as I can tell, you know, I'm not a Zen teacher, but I think the idea is that learning to stay with physical pain, learning to kind of to not run away from it and to kind of stay with it, develops a capacity. It develops a kind of container. And the idea is hopefully that will generalize into the other kinds of pain in our life, you know, emotional pain or, you know, other things. So something about that. Non-avoidance. I think of it as non-avoidance. You know, just face it directly and build that container to hold it. I think it does work to some extent, at least for me. So those three things, it's like just sitting, no gain, non-avoidance, kind of a reconditioning. And I just thought it was a really beautiful practice there. Just enter the moment. Just be what is. And I think if there's one thing that I took away from that experience was learning, you know, when I meditate, and hopefully in other parts of my life, learning how to leave myself alone. You know, it's like, fine. It's okay. Something about that. And so for me, that's very close to something like unconditional love. And I think that can be a very helpful foundation for Vipassana practice. So those three month retreats were in 2005. One of them was led by Mel Weitzman, and the other was led by Paul Haller, both wonderful teachers. I became very close to them. Another teacher who was very helpful to me in Zen is a man named Barry Majid, who teaches in New York City, and he's in the Joko Beck School. Also a wonderful person. So I came back from Tassajara and I felt very motivated to sit more intensively. But I was looking for a way to kind of combine intensive meditation with living in the world, you know, living a householder life. And I was fortunate to have, you know, the time and the money and the health to be able to start doing some longer Vipassana retreats, you know, a month, I did 2 months, 3 months. And when I started doing long Vipassana retreats, I made a somewhat startling discovery for myself, which was that I didn't really know how to meditate. And all those years of Zen practice, which were so helpful for me and so powerful, I feel that there are a little bit more about cultivating a global attitude to life, to practice. But it's not exactly meditation in the way we think about meditation here. You know, and Zen teachers are very quick to say, Zazen is not meditation. You know, Zazen is not meditation. It's like, okay, but what is meditation? That's what I wanted to know. And I think sometimes in practice, there can be a time when you are just very ready. You're very almost like ripe to get specific instructions, you know, about how to practice, how to work with the body, how to work with the breath. And, you know, and coming out of these 6 months of retreat, it was like I was ready to take in the Vipassana instructions in a way that I just wasn't ready when I first started sitting here. And so on those long retreats, I learned a lot about how to observe, you know, how to observe very, very carefully. You know, it's one thing to just, you know, it's like, I'm present, it's Thursday night, we're in California, America, the universe, you know, I'm present. And another thing to be present for the very beginning of a thought, you know, to be present for the tiniest microscopic sensation that makes up the rising and falling. So something about that, learning how to observe very carefully, how to concentrate, how to develop deeper concentration, about the difference between concentration and mindfulness, learning about insight. Those were so helpful for me, and I felt like that was something that I could access on a longer retreat, a longer Vipassana retreat. So in a way for me, it was like sitting the longer retreats, there's a movement, there's a progression towards something that's more and more subtle. You know, you're just kind of peeling back the onion in a way, refining something more and more. So that was just my experience, that the on Vipassana retreats was able to access a depth of meditation that I hadn't accessed before. I felt very lucky to work with some wonderful teachers, Spirit Rock, IMS, people like Guy Armstrong, Carol Wilson, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, of course Gil, retreats with Gil, a few Asian teachers like Pa Ok Sayadaw and Sayadaw Upandita. So I think a long silent retreat for me, I feel, is a very special opportunity, because you go into another world, and it's like this world that you go into is totally designed to support you in meditating, and to support you in going deep, as deep as possible. You know, and so you just go deeper and deeper and deeper, and touch something that's that's real, touch something that's true, and then come back. You know, come back from retreat, come back into the world. And find it everywhere. So something about that, this beautiful rhythm. And just discovering the tremendous power of mindfulness, of the mind. You know, people hear them say mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness. And there's something, I mean, it's a powerful quality of mind. It's like magic in a way. And it can grow and it can be strengthened. Anyway, that's been kind of my path. Something about cultivating these two sides of practice, accepting what is, and then, you know, making effort. And making effort in a particular way, you know, a real careful effort. Something of balancing those two sides has been very meaningful to me. And I guess the only other thing I wanted to say is just that I think you will encounter many techniques for how to meditate. There's so many ways to meditate, and there's so many teachings, and there's so many teachers, and it's kind of like skillful means, and it's all good. But I think the inspiration to practice, and the perseverance to keep at it, that's something that's very special. You know, you can learn concentration, you can learn all these things, but the way-seeking mind is something that's very precious and it's very rare. Just think of, you know, how unusual it is to be doing this practice, to find this practice, especially in this culture. So, I heard a great teacher once say, the best technique is your own sincerity. And I really like that. I think that's really true. Something about that, it's like, if you keep looking for the truth, it will find you. And we never have to fear the truth. And that fearlessness or that trust or something, I think, can be a beautiful gift to give to other people. Thank you very much. I think we have maybe 10 minutes if there are questions or comments, complaints.
I was wondering if you can tell what is that made you choose the most Vipassana over Zen? What is the part that was missing? Is it just the meditation part or other things in it?
I don't think I chose. I guess what I would say is my goal is to practice Vipassana with a Zen mind, something like that. Or it's like, I remember one time saying to Gil something like, I feel like in a way Vipassana has verified my Zen practice, what I learned in Zen. So that's at the deepest level, I think of Vipassana as an expression of Zen. And then I do think there's something that I like the idea in Vipassana of there are skillful means, you know, there is a map of practice, there is a way of of teaching that and of learning that. And for me, I just feel so grateful to Gil and to, you know, all of my teachers, but on retreats, the Vipassana teachers who gave me instructions, that was just totally changed my life. And I may have figured it out on my own. It may have taken, you know, another 100 lifetimes or something, you know. So it's like those teachings and the people who offer those teachings, you know, basically out of compassion, you know, they don't have to do that. You know, Gil doesn't have to come here every week, and you know, something like that.
So I asked Gil once why he gave up Zen, and he said, "I haven't given up Zen."
I think for me, Gil was, was my first model, and in a way, you know, he would talk so much about his Zen experience. I just felt that, yeah, there's really no difference. It was like to kind of go between the two, and then also in a way, especially for someone who's younger, who's in their 20s, it's like the Zen model is easy to access because you can go. You don't need any money. You don't need any skills. You can just go, and they'll teach you the practice and give you room and board, and you just work there. And that's you know, a beautiful model. So,
So there's something ironic about, or seems to me that there is, about, you know, Zen, Vipassana, and what you're saying regarding the practice and no practice. I've only sat Zen a few times. I don't know it well, but I've always been struck by there's so much ritual. And I've heard Gil hint at it a few times, but I've never heard anybody so clearly say it, that you don't do anything in that ritual. And so what's the ritual about? And the irony of this.
Yeah, only a Brooklyn person would Yeah, the ritual is an elaborate ruse, kind of a kabuki, you know, show. And it can take many years to realize that that it's empty. And I'm only partly kidding. I mean, this is my understanding, but I feel like the ritual is kind of an opportunity to be mindful, you know, and to actually accomplish the ritual. You have to be pretty mindful, very present, very aware of your body. You know, in Zen, when you walk into the meditation hall, you have to do it with a certain foot. It's, you know, and I don't remember if it's the left or the right. Maybe it's the right foot. But you know, you have to be, and if you do something incorrectly, someone will say, you know, kind of point it out to you. And so I don't know. I think there's something about mindfulness there. Of, you know, maybe that's the one of the functions of it. But it's often in a Zen meditation hall, it's set up like a mandala. You know, so it's this very beautiful way of the monks moving around and, you know, expressing emptiness or expressing, you know, that, but in this very particular form. You know. Steve?
I first practiced at the Rinzai Soto School down at the Zen Center of Los Angeles and actually studied with Joko Beck.
Awesome.
But a lot of, I remember Zen practice is expressing appreciation. And a lot of what you do when you enter the Zendo, I mean, the bowing is, and by the way, this has always been a pet peeve, so I will now get it on the internet. But those of you who bow to your pillow, that comes from Zen, and you're not bowing to your pillow, you're actually bowing to the person on the right and left of you to express appreciation for them practicing. That's how you show respect. And so when you go to your seat, there's no one at your seat, obviously, but there is someone on your right and left, and you bow, or you bow to the people in the Zendo to express your appreciation for them practicing.
Yeah, I remember a Suzuki Roshi quote, something like, "If there's no bowing, there can be no Buddhism," or something like, you know, bowing was so intimately connected to, you know, that understanding of practice of expressing appreciation.
I sat at the LA Zen Center one time. And at that time, I don't know what they knew now, but people were getting hit with a stick. and I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing. And I thought, how do they decide who to hit with a stick, you know? And then, I know. I figured that out later on. But so in thinking about later on, you know, what is the difference between Zen and Vipassana? I thought, Zen is stick, Vipassana is non-stick. Anyways.
The non-stick pan. In Western Zen, in American Zen, at least all my experiences, you have to ask for the stick, you request it. But in Japan, they come to you. And there's a guy who creeps around slowly, tiptoe. And then if you're slouching, or if you're sleeping, God forbid, they'll give you a few. Yeah. And
I have a question. How do you accept life the way it is, like you said, but at the same time, sometimes you feel that you need to make change, like your case, you said that you feel you need to get out of the job, so how do you reconcile that, on one hand, accepting? I mean, that's what it is. On the other hand, sometimes you feel that you shouldn't accept it. You need to make a choice. So,
yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, one thing that I would say is that accepting things as they are includes accepting that you may need to make a change, you know.
How do you know?
Yeah, I think that's where we each have to use our wisdom, you know. And there's, it can be, I think that the element of acceptance in that is being in touch with what you're feeling, in touch with what you're thinking. So it's not just like, you know, this is the way it is, it will always be this way, but it's like, you know, it may be like, this is the way it is, and it doesn't feel okay. You know, when something is off, and it's like, okay, to accept that, and to accept that, you know, so I think the part of acceptance is the part of like just to really be honest with this is the way it is, you know, as opposed to the way I wish it would be. And then out of that honesty, you know, I think there's a wisdom that it's like, okay, what is the appropriate response? Is it to, you know, get up and leave? Or is it to say something? Or is it to, you know, my mother was just telling me, we should probably end after this, but my mother was telling me, she was just in New York, and she was walking on the street, and there was a mother who was screaming at her three-year-old in kind of a, you know, in a way that she felt uncomfortable. But, and knowing my mom, I knew she was going to say something. And because, you know, I just kind of turned around. My mom would. But what she did was she just said, "Your daughter is so beautiful," or something. You know, she just kind of totally changed the, you know, changed the energy. And she could have said, you know, "How dare you talk to her like that?" Or something. You know, so there's many different ways to respond, and I don't think there's a formula, basically. But I don't think accepting things as they are should be confused with being passive. Something that's totally different. Okay, so thank you very much. Mm-hmm.